This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. It's an EFL special. We know we don't have time to cover it enough, and we forgive you if you occasionally cheat on us with other podcasts. So this is a very simple one-hour guide to help you and us catch up on who's good and who isn't, and why none of the goals are the same size in Hull. In the Championship, something like 1 point separates top and bottom. What's going on? Only one team has won more games than they haven't. Can anyone confidently predict who'll make it to the promised land? TM. A bit more stretched in Leagues 1 and 2 with some big hitters near the top of the former. You've made some very simple requests, including please just say Gillingham out loud, so we've achieved one thing already, plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Hello, Max.
The Guardian's EFL correspondent, Ben Fisher.
Hi, Max.
And from the Not the Top 20 podcast, George Ellick. Hey, George.
Hi, Max. Hello.
Let's start with the Championship. I mean, the top is fascinating. No one is walking away with it. 1 point separates the top five, 6 points between first and 15th. As I said in the intro, only one team, Blackburn, who are fifth, have won more games than they haven't. They have 8 wins and 7 defeats and just win a game and lose a game and win a game and lose a game. And Paul says, I've wondered if there's something about this particular season. Has the Championship finally reached the infinite monkeys typewriter stage? 1 point covering the first five teams, Preston North End with their ridiculous goal difference until a couple of weeks ago, Blackburn. Is this the season where a team somehow makes the playoffs and gets relegated? It is ridiculous at the top there, George.
Yeah, I mean, is there a top? Like, is there a middle? Is there a bottom? Like, it's just a big chunk of teams, isn't it, really, at the moment? I think there's a few reasons for it. It does definitely feel like the quality of team that was relegated from the Premier League last season was much poorer. We've seen, I think, especially in the couple of seasons since, you know, the COVID pandemic, we've seen a certain calibre of player, a certain price bracket of player, maybe not quite as appealing to Premier League clubs as they used to be, which meant we saw a lot of players playing in the Championship over the last couple of seasons who probably shouldn't have been. There are a couple this season. You know, Ismaël Assar is probably the obvious one, and João Pedro as well, but Watford aren't doing too well. But there definitely doesn't feel like a team like a Leeds or like a Norwich times two, who are just basically way too good for the division. Burnley sit top at the moment, which you know, some people seem surprised about. People seem to forget that they were about 15 points better than both Norwich and Watford last season. But it's not a great renewal in terms of quality, but in terms of excitement and, you know, the unpredictability of the Championship that even you know, your most agricultural Championship viewer will know about, it's a stellar renewal.
So does that make it the most exciting league in the world? Like, should we all just take our eyes away from the Premier League and start watching ITV4's EFL highlights show?
Well, it is gloriously tight, isn't it? I'm just looking now. I mean, it's 6 points separate first from 15th, which is, you know, just bonkers. You know, in sort of, if you compare that to the Premier League, you've got nothing similar remotely. I do think, though, sort of sadly, that Burnley, Watford and Norwich will probably be right up there at the end of the season again. And I do think that's sort of disappointing or a bit underwhelming in terms of what the Championship maybe will end up like come sort of April, May. But obviously, for the time being, it's good fun. Last season, when Luton and Huddersfield got into the playoffs, they were great stories and probably maybe not the best teams that the league's ever seen. But obviously, that's great. And I think we're going to end up with that again. I think there's going to be some kind of quite poor or interesting teams that squeak into maybe fifth or sixth in the playoffs. And that really, you know, I think is great. And it does open it up to get that, you know, a different story to sort of contradict what I just said about the usual suspects being up there. I think we will see somebody interesting. Maybe Mill might do it this year, who knows, to get into the playoffs. So, yeah, no, it is really interesting. And the span of kind of interest is so much greater than the Premier League, where you could sort of name your top six, seven, you know, in a second.
Could I tip Coventry City to go up through the playoffs and get relegated? Because they currently sit bottom of the 24. but they've two games in hand, and most of their games have been away from home because they weren't able to play at home earlier in the season. So I suspect they're probably in a false position, are they?
I mean, you've missed out the key point there, which is the reason they couldn't play at home is because they decided to play rugby sevens on their pitch during the Commonwealth Games, which is a beautifully EFL reason to suddenly have to play all of your games away from home. But yeah, I mean, they do look to be in a false position. Mark Robbins has done a very good job there. I mean, they did start the season very poorly, but two of their home games have been against sides in the top seven. They do seem to be, you know, it's typical of the Championship right now that the team in 24th definitely aren't the worst team in the division. And what Ben said as well, I mean, I think there's an interesting thing about these sides who do kind of progress. Last season, it was Huddersfield and Luton. Now, I'm not going to be as brave as Ben and start saying that Huddersfield and Luton weren't good sides. And I think there's maybe an argument to suggest that Luton are probably the team who are being ignored the most at the moment. You know, they were playoff semi-finalists last season. Nathan Jones, their manager, has a history of basically improving Luton every single season he's been at the club, taking them from League Two up to a playoff semi-final with a little hiatus in the middle where Luton started to have a downward trajectory again. And they got 2 points from their first four games of the season. And I almost think because of maybe taking Burnley out of it, I would argue that Luton have possibly been the best team in the Championship since the end of August. They've only lost one game since then, scoring loads of goals. They've got a brilliant straight partnership between Elijah Adebayo and Harry Cornick and also Carlton Morris as well. And I do think maybe we're a little bit blinded to their quality because they are little old Luton who play at Kenilworth Road, and you know it's a horrible place to go and they don't play the most attractive football. Whereas actually 15 months worth of good results at the top end of the Championship is probably enough now to start saying, actually, this is a side who everybody needs to start taking seriously.
I quite like ignoring Luton. I mean, the most ignored side, as we know from, is Gillingham. I know they're not, I don't know, we haven't got to League Two yet, but let's talk about Burnley. Ben, Stider says, I'd love a quick catch up on Burnley. Sold 14 players, bought in 15 with a brand new, unproven manager, top of the Championship, playing football that has 70% possession. They probably had the ball more this season than in the entirety of last season.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird as well because they've only won 6 of the 14. Obviously, they are top of the league. I do think kudos to Vincent Kompany, who obviously was a big name, high profile get in terms of the manager there. He's put a really good style on the team. Obviously, as you say, big contrast to what had gone before. Quite brave, I think, to do that, given what had gone before. But it's definitely working. And also, they've kind of got this nice, neat blend of some of the players of kind of yesteryear, if you like. You know, Jack Cork still milling around. And some of these new faces, which they've managed to strike this nice balance. And the destruction of Swansea last weekend, 4-0, to beat a Swansea team, it looked like they were just, you know, hitting some rhythm or were in some good form. To go and hit them for 4, I think it was quite a statement, really.
Yeah, I think Burnley fans can't really believe their eyes at the moment when they go and watch their team play. I think they were sold the idea that in order to compete at Premier League level, they had to play a certain way because of the technical deficiencies they had. And that will be the interesting thing. If they do go up next season, if they do go up and they're in the Premier League, will they stick to their guns and continue playing this way? We're feeling quite smug. I mean, it's too early, but we had our we do our 1-24 predictions before the season starts, and we had Burnley top, and we had a lot of people messaging us saying, "What are you talking about? They are way off it." So at the moment, it's going okay, and the style of football is great. It's worth pointing out as well that Burnley have taken the lead in all 10 of their last 10 Championship games. They've only won 5 and drawn 5 of those, so they do have a slight issue holding on to leads. 3 of the equalisers they conceded were late in the game: 1 in the 87th minute, 2. Well into injury time as well. So in a parallel universe, if they could have seen out games they should have won, Burnley could easily be 9-10 points clear here. And we'd be talking about a team who maybe were who are the new Leeds or are the new Norwich or whoever else, because they certainly have it in them. And I think because of the amount of the influx of players that have come in the summer, they're probably the one team as well who you can see continuing to improve as Kompany gets his ideas across and as they get used to the new style of play.
George, can I take out my big, pointy knitting needle of hubris and stick it into your balloon of smugness?
Oh, no.
By pointing out that, if I recall correctly, in your season preview, you and Ali couldn't relegate Reading quick enough. They were going to be relegated by October, and I... Oh, what's this? They're 6th in the table, 3 points off the top. What's happened there?
I've got to be careful what I say here. There's a, as an Oxford fan myself, and with Reading considering Oxford as a, as an arch rival, I often get accused of bias, and I have to keep reminding Reading fans that as an Oxford fan of a younger generation, I don't consider Reading as rivals at all. But I've still got to be careful what I say. I mean, the one thing I would say to this is that Reading have had an incredible start to the season, and I certainly wouldn't take my prediction back. I think it's testament to the job that Paul Ince is doing that he's taken a squad that looked so devoid of quality with massive off-field issues and taken them to where they are. The other caveat to this is that they are still sixth favourites for relegation right now. So it's maybe a little bit in the same way that my, you know, the Burnley prediction is too early to get excited about. Maybe this is too early for the coffin as well, because you know, the underlying data, the XG data that Reading fans are very quick to dismiss, and understandably so, hasn't been particularly positive around them. Having watched them quite a few times over the last couple of weeks, you know, I was impressed with their performance against Norwich, where they completely shut the game down and managed to draw it 1-1. You know, Ince has created a massive siege mentality, and having, you know, jumped up Oxford fans like me on a podcast before the season started, telling them they're going to get relegated, I think has only helped that. So yeah, all credit to them, but I think even now, after the good start of the season, Reading fans, well, in my opinion, that the first aim should still be to ensure they keep up this form so they can't get sucked into a relegation battle towards the end of the season.
Your face pinned on the dressing room wall of the Majeski. Yeah.
The podcast being played on a loop on the dressing room stereo.
Amy says, Slaven Bilic only has one win in his last three matches. Is he on borrowed time? Ben, how has Bilic done at Watford so far, and what did you make of the kind of Rob Edwards sacking? We spoke to Mike Parkin from the Rookery End podcast, who was actually, you know, we were sort of laughing about it, but he was felt incredibly deflated and sort of let down actually by the owners.
Yeah, undoubtedly disappointing, I think, especially if you're a Watford fan, because all the sort of false promises of sticking by Edwards basically regardless of what happens in that just turned out to be a load of tosh, which probably, you know, a lot of people predicted. I think it was disappointing because Edwards had, you know, I think it was 10 games or 11 games he had, which is nothing. He had obviously come from a totally different environment in Forest Green in League Two, did a really good job there. I just think at Watford, it's such a mishmash of a squad, as it always is. I don't think necessarily he was hugely aware of some of the people that were coming in on the training ground and things still, and that's not conducive to a good setup for anybody. Bilic can probably handle.
Sorry. How do you mean? Who was turning up on the training ground? Just owners and people?
No, I think people were being signed still with, you know, without, you know, the head coach or manager perhaps necessarily desperately wanting them. I do like Slaven Bilic. I do think it's quite a good appointment, actually, for what he's working with. It would have felt a lot, it would have made a lot more sense, actually, I think, to get Bilic in the first place. I think Edwards was such a key change from what had gone before. Like I said, they made false promises that they were going to, you know, stick by it and we're going to do it a new way and this is us now, and they just, you know, went back, reverted to type. I think the squad is still very talented, and like I said, I'd be amazed if they're not in the top six at the end of the season. But as you say, two defeats in the last three, and they're never too far from crisis. But I do think Bilic will get them up there, but it might not be particularly pretty, which is obviously what Edwards is trying to get towards. But I think they'll be up there.
I think it was this time last season there had been one sacking in the Championship. This season, I make it mainly sackings, but a couple of guys leaving their jobs. Alex Neil, for example. Is it nine have gone already?
I think it's more. I mean, I saw a tweet.
Stoke, Borough, Sunderland, West Brom, Huddersfield, Watford, Cardiff, Rotherham, Hull. That's nine, but there may be more.
There was a kind of a viral tweet saying that that Mick Beale, who was appointed in June, was now the 10th longest serving manager in the Championship last week.
So either way, it's over a third of the teams in the division have changed, sacked or changed their manager already. That can't be healthy, is it? Are you surprised?
I'm not too surprised. I just think that the timing of this season is really interesting. And it's the same in the Premier League with this World Cup, because it's like, can we limp towards November, basically, or do we need to act sooner? You know, how grave is the danger here? I think some of the championship clubs, I don't know if the expectations are fair from sort of the powers that be. You know, you take Cardiff, for example. So Steve Morrison is allowed or backed, whatever way you want to put it, to basically totally revamp the squad. Crazy amount of numbers, you know, almost sort of verging on Nottingham Forest, really, in terms of what they've done there, in terms of the turnover. And then he's like out of the door with, you know, I think about 10 games or so. Like, it's, what are you expecting? Like, they weren't doing great. No, I saw them a couple of times and they were poor. They picked up a couple of good results as well. And it's like, well, where should you be? Equally, obviously, the Hull owner has these sort of huge visions, which I think we said at the start of the season, we're either going to go one of two ways. And that's sort of spectacularly fallen flat. But I don't know, some of those clubs, Middlesbrough, West Brom, you'd have expected a lot more from Steve Bruce and Chris Wilder there. I must admit, I'm hugely surprised at both of those not working. But I do think there's an element of just expectations maybe not being on the right sort of kilter, really, with the manager or what they've got in place.
Are you surprised by that it didn't work out with Steve Bruce at West Brom?
Yeah, I am. I thought this season they would be a lot better. What I don't buy into is that, I know Bruce wanted a couple more players. I think Josh Onuma being one, there's a couple more I can't think of, but I can't buy that for a second, to be honest. I thought the squad was more than capable in what is not, you know, it's not a glittering league, as George said earlier. It's not a team that is running away with it. So I think West Brom had more than enough, or have more than enough ability to be in the mix. Signed two of the best players in the Championship, in John Swift and Jed Wallace. That I'm struggling to see why Bruce didn't get enough out of those, to be honest, which I think is quite a damning indictment of him and where he goes now. But I'm surprised they weren't up there, yeah.
There was a piece in The Athletic after Bruce left that contained the information that Steve Bruce had signed two players, one of which was Eric Peters, who was his next-door neighbour, and another one was Brandon Thomas Asante, because he'd been recommended by his son-in-law, Matt Smith, who plays with him at Salford. And if that is the level of recruitment, even though, you know, Thomas Asante has been a success so far, so you can't criticise that, but it does feel like that's taking old-school management to a whole new level.
I mean, it's pretty lucky. I mean, it's pretty lucky that it was Eric Peters and not just, you know, my neighbours, like, you know... He is at least a footballer. Like, you know, like, I don't think Kath next door would have done a job, to be honest. Adam, the biggest story from the Championship, obviously, and the EFL, and probably the whole of football. Adam says, why are all the goals in the EFL the wrong size? And why are we only just finding out this season? Basil Gunas has an in-depth piece of investigative journalism on how the biggest story of the 2022-23 season is the mystery of goals being the wrong size. Two in the EFL, one in the Women's Champions League. Who is behind it? What game will be next? Will we have the giant goals once promised by Sepp Blatter? Yeah, so you had this at Hull Birmingham. You had it at Wigan Cardiff. And then the Wigan Cardiff game, apparently the ref allowed play to continue. And Cardiff's third goal went in off the crossbar that was established to be 2 inches too high. What's happening, Ben?
I was told yesterday that apparently Wigan in Cardiff in that game, both teams kind of agreed that, well, we both have the kind of problem for one half, so let's just get on with it. I think there was an element of it being very close to kickoff by the time they realised. It was a bit like, we can't really do much about this now, which does feel a bit shambolic. And obviously, yeah, Cardiff, you know, made the most of it and scored. But I think I don't quite get how, like, if you're a member of ground staff, like, that is all you have to concern yourself with. Like, surely
well,
that's...
Well, no, okay, come on. You've got mowing the pitch, putting the lines out, corner flags... But surely goals just come in at, like, who's building goals that are just a tiny bit too big? Which mischievous goal manufacturer is doing that?
It's interesting you mentioned Blatter, though, because, you know, this has only started since him and Platini were exonerated back in July. So that's maybe this point. Is his new, he's going around Wigan and Hull just kind of, yeah, lengthening the goals to get his wishes across.
This was a problem in horse racing a few years ago. I remember that someone measured a course and say, a 2.5 mile race was actually a couple of hundred yards too long. And it was just the case that no one had actually bothered to check. So it could be something that simple, you know. No one's bothered to measure them, so they just assume they're all right.
It's not quite the same, but my first ever century playing cricket, which is quite a monumental moment. Remember Jonathan? One of two. Remember Jonathan Wilson burst into tears, you know, talking about his first century. I retired on 101 because, you know, I'd let someone else have a go. You know, it's a good knock. I'm happy with that. And at tee, the opposition scorer went, "You only got 91, mate." And you're like,
"No."
Oh, well. But 91 is a cocky time to retire, isn't it? I think it must have been Adam Hurry. If it wasn't, apologies. Someone who tweeted a picture of the video of the guy soaring the goalpost saying, "This goalpost is not living a charmed life," you know, whatever it is. Like, it looked something quite macabre about soaring a goal.
That was quite a loose definition of your first ever century, that, isn't it, then, I think?
Yes, but I still raised the bat. Yeah. I still, you know, I had all the things you needed for it to be a century. I had everyone cheering.
I think it's been expunged.
Apart from 100 runs.
Apart from 100 runs, it's a very good point. A quick one on you, on Sunderland, Barry. How are you feeling? Carl says, can you make the playoffs?
Yeah, I don't see why not. I think if Luton made the playoffs last season, anyone can make the playoffs because they're operating on a tiny budget with, the second smallest wage bill in the division after Blackpool they had. And I'd be honest, I'd just settle for a season of mid-table meh, but I can see no reason why not. I'd just like Sunderland to finish above Stoke, really, because Alex Neil's a horrible little shit.
All right, that'll do for part one. I'm sure there are other views on Alex Neil are probably available somewhere. That'll do for part one. Part two, we'll do League One and Two.
I'm Grace Dent.
And I'm back. Friends, it's time for your fourth helping of comfort eating from The Guardian. Join me with more celebrity guests like Dono Porter, Graham Norton and Mallory Blackman as we throw the fridge doors wide open on the comfort foods that have seen them through.
You'll notice I'm talking a lot. That's because I'm hoping somewhere along the way I don't have to eat it.
The level of devilment in your face.
Comfort Eating returns on the 18th of October with new episodes released every Tuesday. Comfort Eating with me, Grace Dent, is supported by Ocado.
Hi Pod fans, Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May the 2nd on FX, stream on Hulu. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Football Weekly is live on the 17th of November. We're not doing a tour. We're just doing one show for time constraints in the World Cup and all that. Our Christmas special at Earth in Hackney will probably end up in a pub around the corner. Me, Barry, Lars Sivertsen, Ellis James. It will just be fun to see how nervous Ellis is before a World Cup, Wales in a World Cup, won't it? Tickets from theguardian.com/guardianlive. The event's going to be live streamed as well, sent around the entire world. So you can watch it wherever you are. And it is great when people send us photos in, I don't know, Wyoming or Nova Scotia or Thailand or whatever, just watching our live shows at various times of the day. And if you can't watch it live, you can watch it on catch-up for the following week. That is theguardian.com/guardianlive. Ben, before we start on like who's doing well in League One and Two, are all the clubs, you know, not all clubs are brilliantly run, but are any clubs in trouble? Because, you know, COVID wasn't long ago. A lot of these clubs are on an absolute shoestring. Are there any clubs that we should be worried about?
I don't think so. I do feel like League Two is maybe where that maybe people should be more worried about clubs. But in League One, I feel like it seems in pretty rude health. I think some very well-run clubs actually, for example, Burton are struggling. But, you know, they're very well run with Ben Robinson. They have been for a long time. I suppose Morecambe actually would be a cause for concern. Not the biggest club either. And they're also bottom of the league. So, yeah, they've not had a great start. So I suppose that they're maybe one cause for concern. But I think generally in League One, it's in pretty good rude health.
So, look, to mark your card, Plymouth at top of League One, Ipswich in the other promotion position with Sheffield Wednesday, Peterborough, Portsmouth and Barnsley in the playoff places. Bolton just behind them with Shrewsbury doing sort of surprisingly well, Derby County, and then down to sort of Charlton in 10th. Ben, is League One panning out as you kind of expected?
Yes, I probably didn't expect quite so much from Plymouth again, to be fair. They obviously had a really good season last year. Top of the league, as you say, at the moment, and absolutely flying as well. They're not just sort of different to the Championship, where you know you can be top and it's very tight and quite cagey. But Plymouth are top by sort of some distance, really. Ipswich are obviously up there, have been very impressive under Kieran McKenna. I think Ipswich and Plymouth and Sheffield Wednesday, that top three, are probably superior to some of those other teams, or certainly at the moment the early evidence is pretty impressive for those guys. I do think Plymouth is interesting because it felt like they were building something really special under Ryan Lowe. Obviously he then goes to Preston, his number two Stephen Schumacher sticks around to take the permanent job, the manager's job. Very highly thought of, always wanted to become a manager, but obviously until it happens you don't really know what it's going to look like. But he's done a brilliant job to the point where he's now being linked with the West Brom vacancy. You know, that would be hard to, I don't know the sort of truth behind that link or that report, but I think he's done a great job. A Plymouth team that on paper is, I don't want to be disrespectful, it's a good team, but that you don't look at it and you don't think, wow, this is sort of stacked full of, you know, the sort of the league's best players. But I think they're onto something pretty special. They sort of, they know what they've got. And again, very well run. So I suppose that helps.
It is a worry for Plymouth fans that Schumacher has been linked with the West Brom job, but I think he's been linked with a bigger job before and was quite adamant that he was perfectly happy at Plymouth and wanted to see it through. So I don't know if he'd take it if it was offered to him.
On what Ben said at the end there about them being well run, I mean, I think Simon Hallett, the owner of Plymouth Argyle, deserves massive credit, because Plymouth Argyle are basically the blueprint for how, in my opinion, any club in League One or of that similar size should be run. They do not spend beyond their means. They are very, very clever with recruitment. They had a clear succession plan that when Ryan Lowe left, they were able to ensure that there was some continuity with his assistant getting the job. And then in this market, you know, I think the one thing that people are maybe not ignoring but don't realise is how difficult, you know, Brexit has basically made recruitment in League One and League Two. You might think that that's the area where that wouldn't affect them, but because Premier League clubs and Championship clubs are struggling to recruit from Europe as much as they used to, it means that the dead wood that used to trickle down to League One and League Two doesn't really exist anymore. And when you've got Ipswich and Sheffield Wednesday, who can spend so much more than other League One clubs because their revenue is so much higher, it basically, they can cherry pick the best talent and then the rest are left scrambling in what is a very, very small pool. Plymouth Argyle play the loan market brilliantly. Ben mentioned that they don't have the most impressive squad, but there are a couple of players where, you know, Barley Mumba, who Barry will know all about as a Sunderland kid, now on loan from Norwich. He won the EFL Young Player of the Month last month, a right-footed, inverted left wing back who is just absolutely electric on that left-hand side. Finn Azaz, who won League Two Young Player of the Season last season when he was on loan at Newport from Aston Villa. He's come in there as well. Morgan Whittaker, another one. You know, they've played the loan market so smartly. And then the key one, which was, I think, gives Plymouth Argyle fans the most joy, is Sam Cosgrave, who has had a couple of really poor loan spells from Birmingham to other clubs. So when Plymouth Argyle signed him, they were met with a lot of reviews saying that how poor he was and how they made a massive dud signing. But I'm pretty sure he's the only person with a better goals to minute ratio in the country than Erling Haaland. So yeah, the people at Plymouth Argyle know what they're doing, and they are showing that you don't need to overspend in order to compete with those at the very top if you're well run and you're recruiting in the right areas.
Barry, just for the tape, can you confirm or deny you do know all about whoever that fella was?
I tried to maintain a deadpan expression.
I didn't see a flicker of recognition at all on your face.
Must confess, I have never heard of the kid, but I wish him all the very best.
Now, Ben, I watched Ipswich fluke past Cambridge at Portman Road 3-0, where I'm not sure we had I'm not sure we went into their half, but that's not important. And then the Saturday games I find more difficult to watch in Australia. What I do is I wake up and I go onto the Cambridge United Twitter page and I look away and I scroll back loads. And then I do like my own minute by minute. And I watched us lose at home to Sheffield Wednesday at the weekend. It's very upsetting because obviously when they write the tweet, they put the score at the bottom. But I'd like them to put the score at the top because I'm going the other way. And when you score, there's a big gif and it's really exciting. When they score, it just goes 0-1. But out of Ipswich and Sheffield Wednesday, who do you think has the better shot?
Oh, that's a good question. I would probably be tempted to say Ipswich. I think I've said before, I don't know about something about Sheffield Wednesday just makes me think, I don't know, I think it's Darren Moore. I think Kieran McKenna is probably a better coach, better manager, or will be. Proven. I think Ipswich probably have a better squad as well. Sheffield Wednesday have some brilliant players, don't get me wrong, but Ipswich are kind of the League One all-stars, and I just think that will show over time. I think it's kind of hard to get so excited probably about Ipswich if it wasn't for Kieran McKenna, the fact they've got this kind of bright young thing, obviously the way he's come out of Man United, the fact he's sort of still very baby-faced and all the rest of it, but really in terms of the squad, they're exactly where you'd expect them to be, I think, because of the investment and just the nature, the makeup of the profile of player they've got compared to some of the rest of the teams in that league.
What do you make of Derby, George? I think a lot of people wanted Liam Rossini because he's a really nice guy and looks like a very promising coach. They went for Paul Warne, which meant there was an opening at Rotherham. Fortunately, Cambridge's manager Mark Bonner said, "I don't want to go to Rotherham," which meant I think Mark Cooper went from Exeter. Is that right? I'm not sure who Exeter have got.
Matt Taylor.
Who did I say? Mark Cooper. I was thinking of old Exeter strikers.
He'd have jumped to that job.
My apologies to Matt Taylor. Yeah. And it's just a generic name of lower league managers.
Which one?
What have you made of the Derby situation?
Look, I mean, firstly, I think Paul Warne is a brilliant manager and someone who I would absolutely love to go for a pint with, because he seems like a great guy. He did the Moment of Truth podcast towards the back end of last season, and he came across brilliantly. He was very honest about how he sees himself as very much a man manager and is kind of the person who manages the culture of the club, whereas his assistants, maybe the tacticians, his assistant Richie Barker and the coaching staff have gone with him as well. So, I mean, the one thing I would say about Warne is that Rotherham probably had more patience in him than a lot of other clubs would have done. I think Paul Warne at other clubs would have been sacked a couple of times. I mean, he was relegated three times, and it's not that often that a manager gets to try and, you know, take on the next season after relegation. And Warne was afforded that opportunity three times and each time rightly so, because he took them back up again. The one thing that was slightly confusing to me is that Liam Rossini came in the summer as interim manager and implemented a really, really patient passing style of football where they were second for passes completed behind Ipswich. They were second for possession. They were keeping the ball at the back. And then suddenly they go and bring in a manager in Paul Warne, who's all about intensity, no interest in possession at all. It's all about getting the ball forward and being direct. So in that sense, it's a bit confusing. Warne's had a fairly decent start, although they had a ridiculous game. I mean, the away fans at Accrington in the Derby end on Saturday saw Sean McConville, the Accrington player, miss a penalty in the 37th minute. And then again in the 38th minute, and then Derby scored in the 39th minute. So that was an incredible 3 minutes for them. But, you know, Warne's first home game in the league was a 2-1 defeat by Port Vale, which was a little bit humbling. Two wins either side of that. I have no doubt that, well, in my mind, Paul Warne probably will take Derby to the Championship, whether it's this season, next season, or whenever, because that is what he does. But in terms of the timing, I think it's easy to feel pretty sorry for Rossini, who did a pretty good job in his first managerial job in quite a short space of time and had shown loyalty towards them before that.
Brad says, does Ben have any thoughts on the state of Charlton? Got rid of, cue impression, Roland de Châtelet, who was replaced by an owner who said two promotions was achievable with his investment, been through three managers, still stuck in League One, struggling to break even.
Yeah, well, great result for them. Obviously, last night was first thing to say against Portsmouth, who I'm quite sweet on Portsmouth. Not on a great run, Pompey, at the moment, but I think they'll be up there. But Charlton, it was quite a bold, quite a brave appointment, probably going for Ben Garner from Swindon. I think it's weird, but Thomas Sandgaard had a, you know, he's quite a convincing guy, or he talks quite a good game. But as you say, as the listener says, they've not made really any huge strides, to be honest, over quite a long period of time now. The squad is okay, I think. But then again, if you sort of compare it to an Ipswich or Sheffield Wednesday, I think it's lagging behind those guys. I think Charlton will be okay. I think they'll be in the mix. Obviously, they've had a couple of poor years. I just don't know if I see them getting success this season, to be frank. So I suppose in that sense, it would be another season of disappointment, another season in League One. But I'm happy to be proven wrong.
Quick word on Oxford, George, your side. Not doing too well.
No, it's been a pretty poor start to the season. A 4-2 win on Saturday at Exeter was much needed for Carl Robinson. I mean, I think the frustration with Oxford fans is that Oxford lost a playoff semi-final to Blackpool 18 months ago, or over 18 months ago now. And after the game, Carl Robinson said very clearly what the fans wanted to hear was that they needed more robust players. And we've had quite a few transfer windows since then, and it hasn't happened. No fullbacks were really signed in the summer, apart from Jovan Anderson from Lazio on deadline day, who's yet to really make an appearance so far. So the recruitment hasn't been great, but this isn't the first time that Oxford have struggled to start the season under Carl Robinson and then come back to challenge towards the top end. And it's exciting times as well, because there are new owners who are pretty wealthy, Eric Tohir and Anand Bakri, and there are plans to build a new stadium, which would be much needed given that Firoz Kassam still owns the Kassam Stadium, and Oxford's lease is up in a couple of years' time as well. So not great on the pitch, but definitely reasons to be positive off it, and hopefully under Robinson that good result on Saturday can continue and ease any fears of being towards the bottom end of the table.
All right, that'll do for part two. We'll do League Two in part three. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. The Football Supporters Association Awards nominations have been announced. Go to thefsa.org.uk and you get to a Survey Monkey page if you keep clicking buttons, and you can vote for many things from The Guardian, Robin and the Pod, Robin Cowan, Commentator of the Year, The Guardian Newspaper of the Year, David Squires, Online Media of the Year. You can vote for Barney Ronay or Susie Rack for Writer of the Year. You can vote for us for Podcast of the Year. Are you up for it, George? Are you guys up for it?
We were nominated right at the beginning when we had about 400 listeners, and it was huge for us. Then we've been ignored ever since. Disgrace.
So you're part of the Football Weekly family. So if you like Not the Top 20, you can vote for Football Weekly. And of course, vote for the warm-up with me and Baz and Charlie Baker, because we won last year somehow. And we really have bleated on about it on the radio because we are very surprised. So that is thefsa.org.uk. Look, and the FSA are great, so you should read all of their website anyway and join. Daniel says, Max's usual average EFL reference team of Stevenage sit top of League Two. Could Max in future please choose another side in which to direct his average and sometimes forgettable reference? It's a very good point. Our friend Will Unwin says, can Steve Evans manage in the Premier League? Stevenage doing tremendously well, Ben.
Yeah, we do need to talk about Steve Evans in Stevenage, don't we? It's quite the transformation.
Do you think he's called Steve and it's Stevenage and it's just a sort of, it's just this osmosis?
Yeah, one big happy place, maybe. He's transformed the team, or certainly their fortunes. When he took over their 22nd, I think they were going down when he took over in March. I think they were probably going to get relegated. And then they won four of their final seven, actually stayed up with quite substantial ease, really. He knew what he wanted in the summer, got many of those sort of pieces in the puzzle. It's still, I suppose, Steve Evans style, but I don't think that's anything to be sniffed at when you're getting the kind of results that he is. I mean, they're top of the league. I mean, to be top of the league at this point of the season when you were going down at the back end of last season is just some turnaround. And you wouldn't bet against him, you know, staying there. Really, there's nothing to suggest, for my eyes, that they won't be up there come April, May. So I think it's some going, really. I mean, he's He's 60 this month. He says that he's mellowed. He feels he's mellowed. He feels he's a different character on the touchline, which I suppose...
I mean, the bar was high. Like, you can mellow from there and still be quite angry, can't you?
Yeah, I mean, I spent some time with him and it was quite amazing to see Steve Evans just, you know, in the garden, in the kitchen, just doing that run-of-the-mill things rather than sort of bleating on the touchline.
Were you just staying the night with him?
How much time did you spend with Steve Evans?
A couple of hours.
Okay, right.
I just imagine him storming around the kitchen, roaring at various appliances, and getting incredibly angry at the toaster or something because it's taking too long.
I did say to him it felt very apt that directly behind him there was a Gordon Ramsay cookbook. And I just thought, you know, the stars have aligned here in terms of their effing and jeffing. But no, I think, Stevenage playing Northampton on Saturday. That'll be a big test. Northampton are going really well again. They're third. But yeah, sort of credit to Steve Evans and to Phil Wallace, the owner, to be fair. I think, again, we're talking about well-run clubs and he's certainly a really good owner in the league, let alone League Two.
What was it, Northampton, who got absolutely stiffed on the last day of last season by Bristol Rovers? Yeah, I was worried that they might not come back from that. It was such a devastating, crushing thing to happen, but they seem to be doing all right.
Yeah, they've done well. They've bounced back, as you say, Barry. I mean, obviously, yeah, they, because Bristol Rovers won 7-0 on the final day, Northampton lost out on goals scored, I believe, which is sort of bonkers to still think about now. And even weirder when Bristol Rovers were only 2-0 up at half time. There was lots of theories that perhaps there was something more at play, some dark arts. But yeah, Northampton have bounced back really well. And again, John Brady, quite a sort of steady hand there. So yeah, fair play.
God, I mean, it's just the worst ever transistor radio moment, isn't it? Northampton fans, as every Bristol Rovers goal goes in. Later on in a second, George. Is that where you'd expect them to be?
Possibly. I mean, I think Richie Wellens has done a very good job. I do worry that they started the season almost too well. I always think when clubs maybe didn't have aspirations to, well, didn't expect to be first or second in the league, start a season as well as Leighton Orient did, it kind of changes the expectations around the season, and then the manager can suddenly come under criticism when they end up finishing around about where they're expected to before the season started. Having said that, you know, this is a big job for Wellens. He hadn't, since, you know, taking Swindon up out of League Two, he had struggled at Salford and at Doncaster. So it feels like this is a job where he needed to make it work. And so far he's doing so. You know, they're a good team to watch, scoring plenty of goals. Yes, they aren't going through the best spell at the moment, but there seems no reason why they won't be up there challenging around the top end. Very different style, it's fair to say, than Steve Evans' Stevenage, who are very direct.
Big fan of the extending the he hit it too well to an entire team starting too well and winning games when they absolutely shouldn't be winning
victim
games.
Victim of his own success.
Exactly. How's Mark Hughes doing at Bradford? I saw him control a clearance the other day, which is as far as, you know, and he's still got a lovely touch.
It's a shame he didn't volley it.
What a wonderful footballer he was. Yeah, and he should have, I don't know if he did then, just volley it back into the net from 50 yards, which he should have done. But how's he getting on, George?
Yeah, he's doing well. I mean, it's been a kind of a steady start rather than anything spectacular for Bradford. You know, they are on 24 points in fifth place through 13 games. I think the key thing for Bradford fans and for, you know, for anyone watching on was, you know, would Mark Hughes's heart be in it? You know, when you have gone through what Mark Hughes has gone through as a player and a manager, you know, when you've managed at the top level, when you've managed your country, when you've played for Manchester United and you know, Barcelona and the rest of it, are you really going to be bothered in the twilight of your managerial career to go in at Bradford and give it your all? But everything suggests that he absolutely is. They've been good. The recruitment was good in the summer. He's got Andy Cook, a goal scorer of, I guess, in some ways similar ilk, even if not the same quality to Hughes, scoring plenty of goals. He's been deadly in front of goal this season. So, yeah, I mean, all signs are definitely pointing that Bradford, after a really difficult few years, are back on an upward curve with Hughes at the helm. And I guess it's not particularly surprising that he is so. I think he's often lumped in with some of the managerial dinosaurs from that era, even though I think he's much more innovative and has done better jobs at certain places than others.
I see Salford City are seventh, 8 points off the pace setter Stevenage. Do they still have the biggest budget in League Two by a distance? Is that?
Well, Stockport were promoted out of the National League last season and I think have a bigger budget than Salford. Again, because of the lack of financial constraints in the National League, it's pretty regular now that the team who gets promoted out of the National League or one of them will often have the biggest budget in League Two. And I think if Wrexham manage it this season, they'll probably continue that trend. But for Salford, it feels like they've kind of got it right now after... you know, flip-flopping quite a lot, going back and forth. Neil Woods come in, who was a youth team coach at Manchester United. I think it's quite surprising it's taken them this long to make a Manchester United hire for the first team. The recruitment was good. Elliot Watt is a player that I'm a huge fan of, who was at Bradford before, a very, very classy ball-playing midfielder. And they're another team, they play really attractive football. I think the only criticism is that maybe it's a bit too stale, a bit too much possession for possession's sake. But they get the ball down and play. And yeah, I think they're another one where, even though they're not in the position now where it looks like they've improved, it feels to me like they're finally getting it right in the EFL.
We actually got a little bit of criticism, me and Barry, when we interviewed Gary Neville, for not pushing him hard enough on the way Salford is run, sort of, and what he says about regulation of football clubs and the fact that perhaps they put in a lot of money, if they were to just bugger off, that Salford would be, you know, in real trouble. How is their ownership generally viewed by sort of the rest of the EFL?
In my opinion, the hypocrisy is true when it comes to his opinion on sacking managers and the way that he's maybe treated his managers at Salford. Although he's admitted now that he's got some regrets, I think it's very naive to think that a good EFL owner isn't one who is going to pump money into the club. Yes, that does of course mean that if you are to walk away one day, it might put the club into some financial issues. But similarly, these clubs just categorically do not make enough money from matchday revenue alone in order to provide the necessary funding needed to maintain a promotion challenge. So I think the work that Gary Neville does around, you know, especially recently in light of the rumours that the fan-led review led by Tracy Crouch might be binned by the new government, I think him going on live on, you know, on BBC and talking about that, it does massive favours for the EFL, bringing it to the wider public and hopefully keeping the government to account in terms of not tearing up a proposal made by, weirdly enough, a Tory MP. I've only got praise for his work there, and I don't have any issues with the way that he runs Salford personally, although I can understand that maybe some find it a bit galling to see the way that they do spend.
Here to watch says, could you just say the word Gillingham? So they've been mentioned on the pod outside of being the club no one cares about. Barry.
Gillingham. They have been mentioned on the pod before your time, Max, when James Richardson famously referred to them as Gillingham. Which I suspect was even more of an insult than not being mentioned at all. Could I ask either of our experts who know far more about this than me, I noticed that Crawley Town, Crypto Crawley's plans to get into the Champions League aren't going quite as well as they might have hoped. They're second from bottom with 9 points after 13 games. What's any developments there? What's the story?
Well, yeah, and they sacked Kevin Betsy as well, and obviously his assistant Dan McKeekey, who at the time seemed quite exciting appointments. And obviously, as you say, Barry, they had this grand vision, still have grand plans, but as you say, it's gone pretty pear-shaped. I think I don't want to sort of write them off too soon. I mean, they are in the relegation zone, but it does feel like maybe they've just totally misjudged actually what they're working with. It's difficult to escape that sense that they've just got it really wrong, actually, and maybe it needs to be a bit more, what's the word, orthodox in terms of the ownership and the sort of structure there. I mean, we're sort of talking about some of these clubs towards the top end of the division, which kind of got their head screwed on and just, I don't know, a bit more sensible, I suppose. Whereas Crawley, it just feels it has been quite erratic. It's obviously very bold and different. And the bottom line is it's just not worked. And I'm struggling now to see it working anytime soon. I think the fact that, because, I mean, Betsy was quite a, I don't want to say a coup, but it felt quite a good get. It felt quite a smart appointment. If that's not worked, I struggle to see where they go from here, to be honest.
I do think, even though I agree, and I was actually very excited about Crawley pre-season, the squad and Betsy and McKeekey were good appointments. Having watched them a fair bit, I mean, they were so poor. I mean, they were way worse than the squad was. And I think Betsy moving on was a pretty obvious decision to make. Since they appointed Betsy, they appointed Chris Galley, who was formerly at StatsBomb, to be their new director of football or CEO or just basically running the football side of the club. And he will be in charge of making the new appointment, which I think will be a very positive thing because there's no way. I mean, the squad is good and I'll maintain that. They had some really bad injury issues early on in the season as well. So I still personally think, despite all the gimmicks, you know, we had Preston Johnson on the podcast a few weeks ago and he kind of held his hand up to an extent and said that, you know, some of the gimmicks, such as writing songs about Carlisle United before a game with them, Cumbria, wasn't the greatest idea and wasn't the greatest sign of respect towards another EFL club. I think they are putting...
Also not very funny.
You know? No, not very funny. Not very funny at all.
Yeah.
I do think that they are maybe a little bit smarter than they let off and they are putting smart people in the right positions. And even though this season might be a write-off, I've got a feeling those who are writing off Wagme as a basket case might still be proven wrong.
Then he's not putting NFTs on the bench at this stage, you know.
Not yet. No, okay. I wouldn't. I mean, they are putting YouTubers on the bench, and they're basically NFTs, aren't they? So
are they really? I mean, some YouTubers are quite good at football, but there's quite a jump
for an FA Cup game. They were scouting at that game the other day. I mean, I don't even know about this stuff.
Wow. Okay. But, Jack says, I would love to hear the insight on the EFL considering ending the 3 p.m. Saturday blackout, making every game available for broadcast from 2024-25. As a foreign Pompey fan, I'd be delighted to see more games broadcast, but it could be a big problem for clubs' match attendances. That's interesting because I can watch every game on iFollow from Australia. The midweek games are available for fans in the UK, but Saturday 3 o'clock are not. Ben, what do you think?
Yeah, I think the EFL, there's a appetite to kind of just open things up a lot more than things are at the moment. I think they want to kind of present this sort of blank canvas to rights holders or broadcasters to kind of get on board and say, look, what do you want to do with this product, I suppose, in really crude terms. I do think the suggestion that Google, Netflix and some of these other big hitters are potentially interested is maybe a bit of a stretch too far. I'm not sure how genuine that is, as exciting as it sounds. I think the prospect of it being divvied up and you know, a world where you perhaps have, for example, Sky taking this part of the pie and then somebody else takes this and maybe a free-to-air showing or something, I think is encouraging. I think it would be a positive step. Ultimately, I think there's still so many games, matches, stories that just fall by the wayside in the grand scheme of things in the Premier League. So I think from the EFL side, there's an appetite to reach more people in sort of basic terms and just kind of get seen more. I think the Championship and the playoffs are massively popular, but perhaps beyond that, it does kind of get a little bit lost, perhaps. So the 3 p.m. blackout, I think would be a positive step towards that. The streaming seems to be quite popular with clubs. That seems to be quite a big thing. So, and it's little things at the moment where clubs, like highlights, they can't put them out until I think it's 1 a.m. in the morning and things like that, whereas, you know, trying to eradicate sort of archaic kind of type rules like that would be a positive step, I think.
With the streaming itself, it's how that money is distributed. Because if you think about what it's like for a club, you know, using Accrington as an example, because Andy Holt is very vocal about this on social media, when Derby, when Ipswich, when Sheffield Wednesday come to town, the revenue that generates for Accrington is massive. And if suddenly, you know, an Ipswich fan can sit at home in Ipswich and at 5 o'clock be sat on his sofa after the game rather than having to come back from Accrington, they're probably going to do that. And the loss of revenue that will cause for a club like Accrington could be transformative. In terms of the actual product itself, part of the reason...
Sorry, George. So what you would say is, or what Accrington would say is, they need to get some of that money.
Absolutely,
right?
Yeah.
All of that money, or all well, of no, that I money, mean, or
it's just money. Just the loss of revenue. It's just making sure isn't a loss of revenue for them in terms of what's going to happen there. And then for the product itself, I think this will inevitably cause smaller attendances. You know, I live an hour and 45-minute drive from Oxford. When I go to a game on a Saturday, it's basically 4 hours in the car. And I can guarantee, sadly, that if I woke up on a February morning and it was freezing outside and I looked outside and I thought, you know what, I can watch this from the sofa. it's going to be hard to say no. And I'm not the only one who will do that. So therefore, suddenly, if you're cutting the attendances at already fairly empty stadiums, it's just going to make the product worse. It's just going to make the games worse. It's going to make the atmospheres worse. I think we've got to be really careful here. I mean, I would be massively against getting rid of the Premier League 3 o'clock blackout, because I think really then, you know, you're cutting your nose off to spite your face. But yeah, I just think this is a little bit of greed that could end up, you know, I understand there will be some people who want it for personal reasons, but in terms of the well-being of the EFL itself, I think we've got to be very careful.
Phil says, how has it come to pass that Sky have allocated one game on the day of the World Cup final, which I think is a 3 o'clock kickoff UK time, Millwall away at Luton? How are fans supposed to get back from a 12:30 kickoff to watch the World Cup final? Wasn't there supposed to be a clear fixture list for that day? So Ben, is it right? League One and League Two carry on through this whole thing. The Championship stops completely, does it?
Yeah, Championship will crank up. What is it? Sort of, I think there's a couple of rounds of games in the event of sort of in the semis or quarters of the World Cup. It's very late in the competition, so I think you'd be hard pressed to find potentially a Championship player involved in that. But it could feasibly happen. For example, if Wales went all the way, I think some of those players would be therefore missing in the Football League.
It does seem harsh, you know, England in the World Cup final. You know, that's whoever's like Sky going, welcome to Super Sunday as the Lions travel to Kenilworth Road and we'll do 2 hours of post-match, even though England are playing Argentina in the World Cup final at 3 o'clock.
David Proton is already planning, how can I get out of this? I want to watch the World Cup final.
Finally, John Granville's long throw says, who will win I'm a Celebrity, Adebayoac in Fenwa or Adebayoac in Fenwa? Never was there an absolute cert who was going to go into the jungle after leaving football. And I don't think anyone else, even though Boy George is apparently in it. But I foresee Boy George and Akinfenwa striking up a marvellous friendship and the two of them coming numbers one and two. Do you want to know who else is in it?
Yes.
Tom Daly. Natalie Cassidy, is that?
Sonia from EastEnders, I think.
Sonia from EastEnders. Danny Dyer as well. So two EastEnders in there. Chris Moyles and Mike Tyndall, amongst others who I...
Danny Dyer and Akinfenwa, yeah.
That is proper naughty.
Round the fire pit.
Isn't it? That'll do for today's pods. Thank you so much, George.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Ben.
Cheers, Max.
Thank you, Barry.
Cheers, Max.
Now there's another brilliant podcast from The Guardian, Comfort Eating, with Grace Dent, returning today for a fourth series. Join Grace and celebrity guests, including Graham Norton, Mallory Blackman, and Dawn O'Porter for a fourth season of the show as she throws the cupboard doors open and chats life through food. Available wherever you get your podcasts. Meanwhile, Football Weekly was produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Danielle Stevens.
This is The Guardian.